Hello, and welcome to the TV Movie Rewind Podcast with Matt and Todd. This week we are joined once again by Sean Reynolds.
Hello.
And we are going to discuss the 1981 Australian war film, Gallipoli, directed by Peter Weir and starring Mark Lee and Mel Gibson, or depending on, you know, which country you probably first saw it in, Mel Gibson and Mark Lee.
Oh, did they change?
Yeah, well, I mean, especially once Mel Gibson started to become more of an international star, I think they put him in top bill. I mean, I've never seen any proof one way or the other, but I mean, well, I think they probably both get equal time. You spend the first portion of the movie with Mark Lee.
I would say, yeah, I would say, like, you know, I would say it's as slightly more of a Mark Lee film than a Mel Gibson film, I guess, slightly.
But this is a war drama, but, you know, I would almost say it's about as much about Gallipoli as James Cameron's Titanic is about the Titanic.
I'd say that's fair.
It's really more about the friendship between two guys who just happen to meet up and join the Australian army and get shipped off to Gallipoli in the year of 1915. So in some ways you could say this is a prequel to 1917.
Yes.
Which does have kind of a similar... At least, I mean, like, the very end, as we'll get to, the very end of this movie is almost like what all of 1917 is kind of about.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's so much more than, again, like, it's a buddy film, but it's about, you know, this almost a spirit of adventure and identity of a country that wasn't quite its own country yet. It was still part of the British Empire, so they were basically fighting in the British Army despite being, you know, Australian, New Zealand Army Corps. And I should point out we're recording this in time for what is in Australia and New Zealand Anzac Day, which is, you know, basically their equivalent of our Memorial Day here in the United States. And this is a big...
Go on. Sorry. Go on.
Gallipoli is a big source of pride for them. And justifiably so, because it was really... I don't know how... What else to say about the courage of these men that were battling for a piece of land that they may not have even known where it was, but were willing to give up their lives for their country.
Of just like walking into gunfire to do it. Like there's not much in tactics now, you know. It's just kind of like, all right, go and let's hope you make it.
Yeah. It's a different period of time. You know, we could make it almost the equivalent of signing up for the American Civil War, where these kids were on the farm and, you know, they thought they believed in something, so they ran off to join the army to fight, whether it was a sense of adventure. And that's touched upon when Mel Gibson's group is first discussing, like, you know, oh, let's go join the army, you know, because women like a man in uniform. It's an adventure. And what were they given? I mean, come on. The cush lives, the life I'm leading, where I spend, you know, most of, you know, a good portion of my day just watching TV and, you know, just doing whatever I want, as compared to what my life would have been if I lived 100 years ago, where I'm having to get up at dawn to, you know, milk the cows and, you know, do whatever, just do what it takes so that I could, you know, live and eat throughout the day, joining the army might have seemed like, well, let's go join the army. Yeah, we have to march and drill and do all this, but we'll get three square meals a day. And, you know, we'll never have to worry about where our next meal is coming from or you know, whatever. You know, the Archie, our main character, Archie, played by Mark Lee, grew up on a farm, which, you know, farming ain't easy. And Mel Gibson's character and his friends were working on the railroad, you know, laying track. This is hard life. That's a hard life to do. I can understand, you know, taking the risk and joining the army.
Yeah, well, for me, at least in terms, I would say that's certainly true for Mel Gibson's character. Like, for him, he was just kind of like, not that he was lazy or anything, it was just kind of like, yeah, this is backbreaking work that I'd rather not be doing. Like, he wants to be his own, he wants to be his own man. He wants to. Arch seems to enjoy what he's doing, but he just has other aspirations. Plus, you know, again, a sense of duty. I think part of it with him is like he just kind of feels remote, like so remote in Western Australia, especially in the early part of the century. I mean, putting down the railroad. So I imagine like a lot of it is just the adventure of it, or at least, I mean, that's what he seems to say throughout the movie, because he never has a doubt. Like, he just wants to join. He wants that. He's got that sense of duty and that sense of adventure that I think. Thinking that there's got to be something else to see other than, you know, just the miles Australia that I see like every day. You know what I mean? Like, this isn't necessarily the life for me. He wants to.
Yeah, I'm sure like war must seem like a romantic notion if you're living in a time when you can't see movies like Gallipoli,
right?
that drive it home for you, like how unromantic it really is, and how much right, you really right. do not want to do this.
Right. I think when you're being told by general with like, you know, 900 medals,
right,
you know, years later after the fact, exact to tell, yeah, it probably seems really, you know, bronco busting or whatever.
Yeah,
well, Archie, when we first meet Archie at the beginning of the movie, he's, you know, run practicing, he's a runner. I would say what, the 100-yard dash is what we see him trying to do at the beginning.
He's, yeah, 100 meter, 100 yards, something like that.
He's being trained by his uncle, who's also told him about all his war stories, you know. And he's almost like Luke Skywalker.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking Uncle Owen.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of.
Uncle Jack, Uncle Owen.
Yeah. Uncle Jack is more like Ben Kenobi, where parents are like Aunt Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, he's living on the farm, you know, he's an excellent runner. He's doing whatever that, you know, 100 meter is in under 10 seconds. You know, he's got the mantra that his legs are steel springs and they're gonna, you know,
hurl him really fast, like a leopard. And, yeah. Like a leopard. Yep.
And, you know, so he's training for this meet that's going to be taking place in Perth. And he's also thinking about joining the army, specifically the light horse, because he's also an excellent horseman. You know, growing up on a ranch, breaking horses, it's no doubt that he's got no problem riding horses.
And that certainly served him well in battle, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because he also immediately says, like, at one point to one of the recruiters, like, it's like, why is it so important when Mel Gibson can't do it?
Right.
Well, again, it was because they were sent to Gallipoli as infantry. I don't know. You look at the terrain they were fighting in. There's no, you're not riding a horse through that terrain,
right? On a rocky cliff or whatever,
right?
But you know, like we said, he's got the dreams of joining the army, which he can express to his uncle, but. He's only 18. You need to be 21 to join the Australian Army. But, you know, as they say, especially back then, it's so hard to prove one way or another when, you know, what your birthday is. So if you go and you look old enough and you want to sign up, they're more than likely going to let you. So we meet a little bit, you know, he's, you know, got some, he's got that rival that somebody always has when you see them in, you know, in their youth. There's the jerk guy who, you know, like makes fun of him for being a runner. And his friend rather unfortunately says, well, Arch can run faster than you can ride a horse, which
is a hell of a thing to say.
And everybody knows it's ridiculous, even Archie. Right. But they decide to make a bet of who will reach the ranch first. Archie running on foot or his rival riding a horse. And the bet, of course, isn't Archie can run the direct line to the ranch, whereas the guy on horseback has to follow a trail, which adds 5 miles to his journey. So everybody's like, okay, that's, you know, a fair bet. Let's bet on that. And the guy bets Archie, makes the stipulation that Archie can't wear his shoes. And Archie makes the stipulation that the guy can't have a saddle. He's got to ride bareback. Well, Archie's making a great show of himself, running across the desert, you know, cutting up his feet. You know, you see his feet getting all bloody and he's having trouble running, but he does manage to win because, as we find out, the other guy fell off his horse before he reached the finish line. So it's kind of funny, and they're celebrated, but you're also kind of like, well, did the other guy survive?
Well, that's what I was. Do we ever see him again?
That kills people. We do see him again. We do know he survived.
Okay. I think I might know who it is then, but I won't say anything.
Yes. So while Archie is, you know, preparing for the track meet in Perth, where he's going off with his uncle, we meet Mel Gibson and his friends, who are, you know, living in tents along the railroad that's being built, and they're discussing. And we should say, all throughout the film, anytime you see people listening to the radio or getting news. Or the newspapers, everything's talking about the fighting that's going on in Gallipoli during World War I on the news. For those unfamiliar, Gallipoli, it's called something else now, but Gallipoli is part of what's now Turkey, and it is on the extreme end of Europe. It's where Europe meets Asia, right where Constantinople is. Actually, it was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul.
It's nobody's business but the Turks.
They might be giants.
They might.
So, the plan for the Allies during World War II was to capture the Gallipoli Peninsula, which would cut off the Ottoman Empire from Europe, make it easier to take Istanbul. And best of all, it would be easier for Allied ships to move between the Black Sea and the Aegean Sea without facing bombardment from artillery. And it's important, especially because the Russian, you know, Navy was only really to get out of the Black Sea needed to come through the Straits of Gallipoli. So this was an extremely vital piece of land they were fighting for. You know, this wasn't like, you know, sometimes you hear like, you know, these bloody battles like in Antietam during the Civil War, where it's like, well, what was it all for? It was, you know, almost a useless stretch of ground. This was of vital importance, much like, say, you know, the Alamo for the fight of Texas independence. So they're all discussing, you know, about joining up for the army because, you know, they love a man and women love a man in uniform. And it's a spirit of adventure and a sense of duty and pride. Whereas Mel Gibson is the only one there who's like, yeah, no, that doesn't sound all that great to me. But regardless, they decide to quit their jobs on the railroad and they all go off to join, except for Mel Gibson, because as we find out, he's a runner as well. And they end up meeting in Perth, where he goes to join the race. And he's known as when he signs up, they allow him because he's competed before, and he's known as a guy who starts the race kind of standing upright as opposed to down on all fours like most sprint runners tend to start out as.
And well, so they're not, that's where they're heading to when they go through the desert there.
That's right, yes.
Like, they're somewhere in Western Australia, they probably said, but I don't remember.
It's like the nearest, it's the nearest big city.
Right, whatever is
the match.
Right.
So, Arch and Frank, who's Mel Gibson's character, compete in their first race, and Arch wins just by a hair's breadth. And Mel Gibson is, you know, who would have bet money on himself, because this is basically, he's almost, you almost get the idea that he's going to be a race hustler. That's how Mel Gibson plans to make his money, because he'd bet 20 quid on being able to win the race. And so later, when Archie's having breakfast and Mel Gibson meets up with him, sits down with him, and the waitress wants to know if he wants to order anything, he's like, you know, playing with the waitress a little bit, but he doesn't order anything because he doesn't have any money. And he basically, you know, finishes off Archie's breakfast, and they basically become friends. And they decide that together they're going to go to Perth to... No. Archie tries to join the light horse. But right. The friend who bet him in the race, who fell off his horse, tells the army that he's only 18. So therefore he can't join. And that's when later on Mel Gibson convinces him, well, if we go to Perth and you try to sign up there, they don't know you're only 18. It's another chance for you to join the army. So they jump on a train together, and unfortunately it takes them to basically a train station that's in the middle of nowhere, where they're told they can either wait 2 weeks for the next train or cross this dry lake bed of a desert and get to the nearest another train station, where a train will be going to Perth in just a few days. Again, like this is a buddy movie. So as they cross the desert, they get to know each other even better. We know Arch has, you know, survival skills because he knows how to use his watch and point the hour hand at the sun to know where true north is. We get the idea that Frank is definitely the more cynical of the two, because as Todd said, Arch is pretty upbeat the entire movie.
Yeah, there's no doubt with him.
Yeah, this is an adventure for him. They're going to find their way. Everything's going to be fine, whereas Mel Gibson's like, we're going to die in this desert. Where's your son now? Yeah. This sucks. I don't want to join the army. What are you, crazy?
Different. He grew up a city boy. Well, you know, he came from the city. He just thinks differently. He doesn't care, you know. I mean, I'm sure he the fighting men of Australia to win, but it's just not where his mind's at. He's trying to start his business.
Well, and we also now know from his that he's got an Irish background, right, and you know, doesn't have any love of the British Empire, and neither does his dad, who we will meet shortly when they make it across the desert. And they end up staying with his dad for a little bit. All the while, you know, Mel Gibson's also trying to help Archie look older by gluing hair to his lip to make him look like a mustache. You know, here, drink some more whiskey. That'll make you look older, too. Look what it's done to my dad.
He looks like a wreck, but he's only 35.
Yes. So, long story short, Archie, because of his horse skills, is accepted into the light infantry. But Mel Gibson's lack of horse skills, including lack of being able to get a horse to go, is denied entry. And he ends up joining the infantry. But fortunately, when he gets there, he's able to reunite with his three pals, and they all join together. One of the best, most beautifully, because if those unfamiliar with, possibly unfamiliar with Peter Weir, he directed Picnic at Hanging Rock. He directed The Last Wave, Witness with Harrison Ford. He's a very visual director. And when the both are, you know, infantry and light horse are sent off to Gallipoli, we see these night landings, which is one of the most beautifully shot scenes, not only of the movie, but just this almost this eerie ghost-like quality as the ships, the landing ships move towards land in the darkness, all while artillery is going off. But it's almost like a quiet, like the sound right. is being absorbed. It's haunting. It's almost like there's these, it's like out of a supernatural movie, as these ghost ships move silently through the mist. It's just a beautiful, beautiful scene, which is all the more haunting knowing the horror that's going to come once they've made landing in Gallipoli.
Yeah, it's all done like really foreboding. Like everything is kind of ridge. You don't really see the enemy too much. I mean, I think it's for anyone who's not familiar with the film, or with the rest of our podcast, it's probably, you know, important to mention that there's really no. It's not Attack Force E or something where the whole movie is like say a back and forth. In this case, no, it's what about the last 20 minutes or so. Everything is about the situations that led them to these horror that they'll face. That it's done, I think, is really cool, and that it's really neat. And that it's just you only really see the like you don't really even see what they see, and I'm not even sure that they see what kind of charging. You know, they're just going up and over, and then that's it. It's you know you don't even get the. Is the right word, but you don't even get the chance to know what's even coming at you. It's different. Like usually a war movie, it's a bit of back and forth, you know, maybe you don't see too much of the yellow lines, but you certainly see enough of the enemy and the, how the battles are drawn out. That's just not what's done here. It's much more claustrophobic.
Well, a good portion of the movie is about their training in Egypt as well.
Right. You know, well, it's like they're having fun. They're getting their adventure. Like they're having a good time. All that everything up until that point is kind of working out for them.
Yeah, you know, they're you know, it's the adventure they were seeking.
Right.
You know, they're not in, while they're in Egypt, they're not facing any danger. You know, they're going to the brothel, you know, to lose their virginity. They're engaging in mock warfare where it's there that Archie and Mel Gibson reunite. Yeah. And they're able to convince the light infantry to take on Mel Gibson because they're both runners. And at one point, one of the recruiting officers says, well, you know, somebody who can run that fast, we can find use for you on the battlefield. And there's a scene like just before they're about to be shipped off. Well, they're sent with messages to their commanding officer, to this, you know, big officer dance, you know, very posh, you know, there's an orchestra playing, people are dancing, people are drinking, you know, Archie arrives with the message for his commanding officer, and one of the people says, well, that's him over there, you can take the message to him yourself. And, you know, when Archie goes in, Mel Gibson sneaks in behind him to get a couple of drinks at the bar, and Archie hands the message to the commanding officer, who says, when you leave, would you please tell Frank that, you know, this is party is for officers. And then when he reads the message saying that he and the company are about to be shipped off to Gallipoli, the officer changes his tune immediately and says to Archie, you know what, before you guys leave, why don't you have a drink or two? Because he knows the messages coming out of the, you know, out of Gallipoli are not good.
The reaction by Archie, because Mel Gibson doesn't know, like he's up at the bar. The reaction by Archie, do you think he knows the colonel had a change of heart there?
Do you think no.
he did?
No,
that's something I would have picked up on immediately. I would have been like, oh no.
No, yeah, I mean, again, it's easy to understand the subtext, you know, when you're sitting there watching the movie.
I think I would have picked up on it then and there.
Yeah.
Because you should be thrown out. That's regulations. It's the army, right? You should be thrown out immediately. He should be. He's not.
But,
you know,
Archie is a somewhat naive character. I mean, he literally was raised on a farm, you know, probably doesn't have much more than a what we would consider a grade school education. So, yeah, I think the subtlety was lost on him.
Oh, no. I agree. To me, that's one of the scenes that really sticks to me. It's like, oh man, you have no idea.
Right.
But when they do arrive in Gallipoli, like I said, after that really breathtaking sequence, it's almost a contradiction of boredom and excitement all at the same time, because they're wandering around the trenches back and forth, just doing these mundane tasks, all the while Turkish snipers and artillery are being bombarded with them.
Yeah, like I like exactly why, but he needed to get like needed to punch a hole in something, so he just kind of hangs the tin or whatever around the corner for a sniper.
Yeah, you know,
it's like that's just what you do.
You know, they decide to go for a bit of a swim, and all the while. Artillery shells are hitting the water around them, and snipers are firing down, and one guy, you know, gets hit, but because the water slowed the bullets down, it's almost like, hey, look, I got shot through the head. Isn't this fun?
Yeah, that was an interesting scene.
it's almost like you and your neighbors just like daily taking with like rifles and just being like, that's just what it is.
Yep. This is the neighborhood.
That's just our life now. Yeah. Yeah. Because they're like each other.
Right. You know, reading the credits at the end of the movie, I guess the underwater stuff was shot by a guy named Rod Taylor, who I'm pretty sure did some of the real shark footage for Jaws. I'm pretty sure him and his wife did like the shark tank footage.
Yes, when it's attacking the shark, the cage.
Yeah, yeah, the shark. Oh, cool. Yeah, the shark cage, rather. Yeah, I was like, oh, that's interesting. That makes sense. I think he was from Australia. That makes a lot of sense.
Sure, probably would have known Robert Shaw too.
Yeah.
Another wonder. I mean, it's all wonderfully shot. Peter Weir is a very visual director.
Oh, it's a beautifully shot movie,
and the
soundtrack is fantastic.
Yes,
all of it. No matter what version, no matter whether it's the synth, whether it's the super or the orchestral track, it's fantastic.
The synth took me by surprise. I was like, that is a bold choice for a historical movie.
But it worked.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It worked. I thought it was great.
I agree.
It does seem like something more fitting to like a science fiction.
Right? Yeah.
Like I was thinking probably semi-appropriately like Run Lola Run.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
But, you know, like as they're going around their lives, they're noticing also how jaded some of the other soldiers are, because as they're going through a trench at one point, there's a body that's obviously been buried by an artillery shell, but just the hand is sticking out. And as some of the soldiers go by, they shake its hand like, oh, good to meet you. You know, the gallows humor as it's going through the trenches. And we get to the point at the where the British, they find out the British are going to be making a landing. And in order to bring the heat off the British as they make their landing, the Australian forces are going to have to charge the Turkish trenches.
Which is, it's a weird choice. I don't know why they did that. That's not why they were there. They were there to actually protect the they mentioned the British. That may have happened, but that wasn't the point of attacking the neck here, which I thought it was an interesting choice to do that. I don't know if it's in the book or what, but Yeah.
I assume most of the choices made as far as historical accuracy or inaccuracy goes are just for to make the film move dramatic along effect, or, yeah. you know, because they don't get into any of the real history or the strategy, but I think
right.
that's
important. Well, I think we see the strategy in the film. as far as I know, like legitimately, it's just the reason for them being at that particular battle is the movie says it's no less important, but it's not quite what the movie says, which I just thought was an odd change.
But since the movie is being told from the point of view of Archie and Frank, they wouldn't really know the intricacies of strategy or what's going on either. They right. would just know what their orders are, and that's it.
Right.
So they're planning on, like, charging the Turkish lines, which are lined with machine guns. So you're basically telling these soldiers that run across this open ground straight into those machine guns and take those positions the machine guns are holding.
Yeah, it's almost like the Zap Brannigan strategy from Future. Mentioned sending like wave after wave of soldiers because he knew like the kill bots murder count or something and that they had reached their limit.
Well, and again, it kind of shows where, like, you know, this was
with bayonets, no less.
I was going to say, any thoughts about why they were specifically telling them to like not load their rifles?
other than that's historically accurate, I'm not sure what the point was.
Like, yeah, unless I was thinking like maybe they just don't have enough ammunition. Like, you know, maybe why would you do this?
I don't know that either. That was the plan.
They very specifically gave them that order.
I mean, if you're running the trench, I'm not sure how much good a giant rifle is going to do you on the road. It seemed interesting. I think they figured they would get there so fast that would be the more useful. Right. I don't know, but I thought that was interesting too. That, you know, they go out of their way, no bayonets, nothing in the have a bullet.
Yeah, like if I got shot in the leg, I can't lie down and take pot shots at the machine gunner, you know, like right. I could just get to sit there and wait to get strafed again.
Right.
I think Todd has it right where it's like I believe when you're trained to fire a rifle, you're trained to, you know, take a knee and fire. Whereas the idea was for them to move as quickly as possible.
Right. Just get there.
And, right. you know, yeah, do a bayonet charge. But it's, you know, World War One is, well, I know a lot of times people consider the Civil War to be the first modern war where more modern tactics were taken. But it seemed like even World War One, from what little I know about it, is kind of still the same, like, oh yeah, you charge across the field and you take the position and it's volley fire.
Right.
But with the advent of machine guns, that's no longer a valid thing.
Right. You're fighting a 20th century war with 19th century tactics. Like, Civil War, they did not really fully grasp exactly how devastating and accurate the weapons they had were. So like, volley fire and those sort of tactics might still work until they quickly, well, is not nearly quickly enough, but they eventually realize that that's just not going to work. You know, these aren't guns. It's huge artillery. It's sustained machine gun.
Well, like in Gettysburg, where Pickett's charge actually did reach the other side of the battlefield. You know, but again, the world they did have the cannons and the Gatling guns.
But and actual horses with it.
Like, that's they weren't facing what the Turks had to fight the oncoming. It was just and another movie I'll be bringing up later. You know, Paths of Glory, where it's about, you know, these generals who just like, you know, yeah, I lost 100 men, but I captured, you know, while I'm right. sitting back in the base camp drinking tea, I captured those positions, and I'm going to get these medals for it, and I'm going to get all the glory off the blood and death of these soldiers I'm sending forward. So they learn that they're going to be doing a diversionary tactic in charging these guns when the commanding officer of their unit goes to Archie, and I think he's aware Archie's younger than he says he is, and he wants to say, you know what, I'm going to have you as a runner because communications might go down. I'm going to need somebody who can take messages back and forth from the command post as quickly as possible if we lose contact through the cable. And Archie turns it down. He doesn't want to be left out of the fight. He's still in this whole honor and glory, and I want to participate in this battle. Offer it to Frank.
Even though the commanding, like, you know, speed could save hundreds of lives, like, he's still, no, it doesn't, unless he's in the fight taking bullets and shooting back. It's kind of tragic, especially when you eventually find out how things unfold and how.
Well, I mean, again, this is, you know, based on history, so. Yeah.
Do we know if these? I mean, are these characters?
I mean, in the context of the movie. So, from what the person of Archie may have by. One of the soldiers who apparently did make it relatively far in this fight, and you know, was seen running particularly fast. I think that inspired Bill, but that's about it.
Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they're both composites of actual people.
Right.
So the commanding officer goes to Frank and offers Frank the same thing, and Frank takes the opportunity to not have to charge the Turkish machine guns and work as a runner. And the time of, you know, the plan is there's going to be the Australians are going to let loose a massive artillery barrage on the Turkish positions. They're going to send so many shells at the Turkish soldiers. They're going to have no choice but to abandon their trenches and, you know, back off the battlefield. And this will give the soldiers a few minutes at least, or at least a few seconds, to charge across the lines and take the Turkish trenches. Unfortunately, they did not synchronize their watches. And the artillery commander ends his barrage at 4:30. The commander of the charge, his watch says it's only 4:23. So unfortunately, he pauses thinking, you know, I can't send my men out there right now. The artillery may still be coming, and I don't want my soldiers to face friendly fire. And as the silence continues, you know, they're like, well, the Turks are going to retake those positions and set up their machine guns. We need to go. Again, the officer in charge is like, yeah, but maybe they're waiting for them to retake the trench to send one last barrage of artillery. Unfortunately, that is not the case. And when the commander of the whole thing back at his headquarters calls on, it's not a radio, there's a cable link. Why aren't you charging? The artillery stopped. And he's like, oh, well, I still have 7 minutes to go, according to my, I don't care. You need to take those positions. You need to order your men to go. You need to charge. And he's like, I can't send them now. The Turks have retaken, the Turkish officer, the Turkish military has retaken the positions, and I'll be sending my men into a meat grinder. And I don't care. You send them. You send them now. So he orders the first charge, and it is absolutely brutal. I mean, it doesn't look like an Australian soldier gets more than 2 feet. Most of them are, you know, as soon as they pop up to get out of the trench, they're shot to pieces. And as horrifying as it is to watch in a movie in the comfort of my own room watching it, I can't imagine what the second wave is thinking when they see the guy in front of them. You know, it's all, again, for people who haven't seen it, I'm sure most people have seen Saving Private Ryan. It's kind of the equivalent of the opening of Saving Private Ryan when those, you know, landing crafts drop their ramps and everybody at the front of the boat is instantly obliterated by machine gun fire.
Right. Except in this case, it's your city pop up over a wall and then just kind of disappear in, you know, the sound of exploding. You know, and maybe you might see one of them fall back, but it's just disappear. That's
the other thing. Some of them, you know, didn't. They were shot right back into the trench.
Right, immediately, yeah.
And, you know, some of them are trying to crawl back as they're wounded. Some are trying to drag their buddies back into the trench, and they're getting cut to pieces. Yeah. And then they send the second wave, which is just as successful as the first.
Right.
But unfortunately, and this is historically accurate, but we don't know really what happened, was that somebody claimed to have seen a regimental flag at the British lines, thinking somebody may have taken a position on the Turkish lines.
Right, and even the Turkish side, like later, said that they had seen the same thing, that did make it, but they didn't last long.
So the commanding officer does not want to send the third wave. He's like, I can't send any more men into that. I can't. And he's talking to the commanding officer when the line is cut and he loses contact. So he sends Mel Gibson with a message saying to the commander saying, you know, I can't send another man. We have to come up with another plan. So Mel Gibson makes the run. He delivers the message, but that commander insists that the charge still has to happen because he's gotten reports, like we said, that there are marker flags over there. Somebody's over in those positions. You need to send more people to back them up so we can take all the trenches. And everybody's like, well, who told you they saw those markers? Nobody. Well, I heard it, but I don't remember who told me, and I haven't seen it myself. So there's, you know, there's a whole bunch of miscommunication going on, and the insistence that this third wave has to go. And Mel Gibson is even more, you know, involved in this too, because his buddy Archie, this guy we've been following since the beginning of the film, is in that third wave. So he goes running back to the guy who's in charge of sending the third wave and saying, no, he still insists you go, but what if we go over his head? What if I run down to the beach to the general who is in charge of this entire operation and see if he will call it off? And the officer says, yep, that's worth a try. He gives Mel Gibson the message, and Mel Gibson goes running off to the beach. And this is kind of, for me, like the hardest part of the movie to watch, because we see Archie and the other troopers all basically writing their notes home, knowing that we're all about to die. We're about to commit, you know, we're about to go charge across, and this is it for us. And this is the first time you see any hesitation in Archie, any type of like, maybe this is a bad situation. You know, people are taking off their wedding rings and putting them in envelopes to leave behind so they'll get back to their family. You know, we cut back to Mel Gibson. Go ahead.
Credit though, I mean, as scared as he is, he's still going to do it. Like, there's no doubt, but he's definitely terrified.
And that's the thing, is none of these soldiers want to go. They all know this is a suicide mission.
They know it's a bad idea, you know, it's a terrible idea, but they're gonna do it.
Is it one of those things where, like, if they disobey the order, they're gonna be shot anyways, or like, because I find it hard to believe that nobody would be like, yeah, I'm not doing that. You know, like,
well, Well, the thing is, there was like, you know, in reality, actually, you know, they did try to get word back to the general to go of the guy who just clearly didn't know and you know, didn't know that.
Right.
Sending them to their death. But it was a matter of, I don't think they ever felt, or at least the average, apparently, it seemed as much as they just felt that, like, that's just how this is. This is just what we're doing, and yeah, you know, what they're doing, I guess, because as far as I know, there really wasn't any threat of insubordination. Like, it was kind of like the movie portrays, like they
right,
as hard as that may seem to believe, I mean, that's just they did it, you know.
I think a lot of it too is that the man next to me is gonna go, I've right, got to go with them.
Yeah,
right. Like, right. I suppose that is part of it. Like, as soon as you see others willing, you're going to be the one that doesn't, you know?
Am I going to let my comrade down? You know, maybe my charging, you know, maybe I can cover for him or yeah, take the bullet for him.
Yeah. How do I live with myself if they go and I don't? Yeah.
Right. Maybe I'll be the one that makes it, you know? And that's actually the other thing, too. Then you have to go home, right, to the calling you a hero just a moment ago, you know. So
there was because as I failed to mention, when they ship off, the people seeing them away are like, you know, treating it like when the Titanic, you know, went off, you know, there's this, everybody's cheering them, everybody's applauding them, there's ticker tape parades as they're boarding these boats to go off to fight in the war. Yeah, it's something I'm glad I've never had to face. So,
Yeah.
Mel Gibson is making his race to the beach. He gets to a point where even he is under fire, you know, from the Turkish snipers and machine gun fire. But he makes it to the beach. He makes it to the general, and he gives the general the lowdown of the situation and saying, like, you know, it's been a massacre. Can we please call off the third wave and reassess the situation? And the general is like, well, we're supposed to be covering for the British landing. Hold on a second. And he says to his one of his officers, contact the British, see what's going on. And they get the word back right away. Well, the British have made their landing. In fact, they're sitting there having tea.
Mm.
And so the officer, the general's like, well, okay, if that's the situation, then no, we don't need to send that third wave. He gives the orders to Mel Gibson and sends Mel Gibson running back. As Mel Gibson is running back, the cable between the forward post and the trenches is repaired. And the officer in charge of sending that third wave gives the order to send that wave. And we keep cutting between the soldiers preparing to exit the trench and Mel Gibson running and trying to get past all, you know, through the trenches. You know, I've got an important message coming through. Clear the way, clear the way, clear the way. The officer who's about to order the charge saying, I'm going to go with them because I can't command these men to do something I'm not willing to do. Everybody's being given, you know, like, fix bayonets, clear your breeches, no bullets in the breeches, get ready, get ready, get ready. And tragically, just seconds before Mel Gibson is able to get there and give the order to call off the charge is called. They exit the trenches. The machine guns tear apart just about everywhere. We get one last vision of Archie that mirrors the opening of the movie as Archie is running across the desert. And he's shot across the chest. It mirrors the way, you know, he would puff his chest out to cross the finish line for the dash. And the movie cuts to black. And, you know, I don't know where else they would even be able to go with it, you know, other than, you know, it's almost like the ending Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Right. Yeah. Except, well, that, you know, that was like, I mean, yes, based on real events, but sort of in that movie sort of portrayed mythically, and they're joking up to the end, you know, like,
right.
This is not funny. Like, you know,
no,
this was not cool. Right. This was not heroic. This was like a tragedy.
Right. Right. But it's like those guys are gunfighters, right? Or at least butches. Right. I'm sorry, well, Sundance, rather.
Like the fact that it freeze frames.
Right.
Yeah. No. Although, yeah. Although no, I know exactly.
It does freeze frame, although we don't actually see them shot. So that's, I mean, we do see Archie get shot. Like it freeze frames at that moment. But you know, yeah, I thought the same thing. I was like, oh, Butch and Sundance, but very, very different.
Perfectly. I mean, those last few seconds between Mel Gibson going off, knowing that they're being sent, having it end that way immediately after, I think that's just, I don't know of a better, maybe more upbeat, I guess, but if you're going
I mean, this is the story you're telling, yeah.
Right, if this is the story that you're telling, I think that's how it should end. Or I'm right to the great, you know, I'm not sure what piece that is, but just, you know, the ending.
Yeah,
the ending score is just perfect on top of it. Plus the red font, I love that red font.
Yeah, and boy, they just stretch it just long enough. They just make you think, oh, he'll make it. No,
right? Like, yeah, oh, like maybe he'll get dragged away.
Yeah,
on a shelter later. No.
Yeah.
Thinking back to when I first watched this movie as a kid, and of course knew nothing about anything really going on or the context of it. I did think like, oh, he's there. He's the last hero. He's going to make it to that. But even then, it's like, what could he have possibly done if he had made it?
If he got there, yeah.
You know, he's this isn't a Rambo movie. Right. He's not going to get there and take out, you know,
the entire trench full of Turks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, pick up that machine gun and turn it on them.
Yeah.
Right. A different war movie absolutely would have done that. But yeah. Yeah. Or at least an action movie, I guess you could call it. I remember when I first saw this, I mean, this was an HBO staple. When I very, very first saw this, I was really young, and I kind of only remembered the end. So for years, I remembered it as a movie. I remembered the ending, because it's kind of sometimes, so a bit of a spoiler, I guess. But sorry, go ahead.
Well, like the poster, technically, I could imagine people seeing that poster and then right at the beginning when they see Archie cross the finish line thinking, oh, that's the poster.
Right, that's the poster, yeah.
Unfortunately, you find out at the end, no, that's the poster.
Right. But no, what I was going to say is, I mean, it's just, you know, of my taste growing up. Like I said, when I first saw this, I really only basically the last, you know, 10 minutes or so where most of the action is happening. So when I saw it again, a little bit older on HBO, I was going to sit down and watch, you know, a Rambo movie or something. Again, context entirely over my head. Boring, you know, but then seeing it again sometime later, it's like, nope, this movie's great.
Yeah. I actually did not see this movie as a child. It was probably like the late 90s when I saw it. So I was well into my 20s at that point.
Oh wow.
But and that's actually the only time I'd seen it prior to just watching it yesterday to prepare for this. And I honestly didn't remember like basically the first two thirds of the movie either. Like
right.
You know, it just didn't have the impact that the end did. But I you know, I understand why they did it, you know. Like you
exactly
want to know these people.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. Like that is that the ending is so harrowing. Hour long movie that you almost do start to like, that is what stays with you. You forget about, you know, yes, but yeah, no, I understand exactly what you're saying. The ending is what sticks with you the most likely. It certainly did for me.
Right.
Yeah. I watched the movie now and you really, I just want Archie and Frank to be able to live forever in those,
yes,
those moments that, you know, Perth and Cairo and
yep.
You know, here we are young,
you know
yeah, young and living our lives and having the adventure we wanted without the horror that they have to face, you know, in their final weeks,
right?
Because right. You know, while we don't know what happens to Mel Gibson's character, you know he's never going to be the same.
Well, he lost all his friends. Yeah. Well, maybe not. Maybe not. There's the two in the hospital later, although Snow's not, one of them might survive.
I took that when he said they won't give me any food or water. I took that to mean he's a goner.
Right. Right.
Right. Like, yeah. Cause why would they, if, you know, why would they give food, limited food and water to somebody who's dying.
Right.
So
unless maybe his injuries, you know, he couldn't, you know, maybe he had a stomach wound, although he'd be in a lot more agony.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just took it like this is a message to the audience that this,
yes,
they have given up on this guy. They've like, probably given him some morphine, and they're just going to let him die, you know?
Yeah. Well, and again, that's something that kind of skipped over, too, is when, you know, Mel Gibson's three buddies are going into a charge, and we don't see it. We hear it.
Right, right.
And, you know, it is until later that, you know, he finds that, you know, one of them who didn't make it back, who's just got this 1,000-yard stare telling him, you know, Billy was shot and Snowy's, you know, was wounded and taken to the hospital. But, right, you know, the horrors that I've just seen are going to be with me forever. And, you know, I can't even imagine not only, you know, the survivor's guilt of Mel Gibson's character, but like, wondering if I'd left a second sooner, if I'd run, you know. And, you know, they show, you know, Mel Gibson is, his character is breathing. They are wheezing. You know, they are showing you that he is putting every ounce of energy he can into his speed. You know, he is racing not for his life, but for the lives of others and his best friend. And he'll be damned if anything's going to slow him down.
Right.
You know, it's like the legendary runner of marathon who ran the 26 miles to report the invasion and then died when he got there.
You're going to wonder going through his head, too, like if it was Archie running, Archie, who would he have made it?
Well, but they later show, like when they had a re-race to the pyramids, they kind of tied. Because Archie was telling Mel Gibson, like, you know, you start at the standing position. And Mel Gibson's like, yeah, you start at the standing position. You don't waste time getting upright. You run faster. But Archie's like, no, you start at that, you know, lower position, and I'll prove it. You know, we'll do another race. You start with, you know, we'll start in the same position. And I'll show you, you'll get there faster. So I don't think it was really proven that Archie was the faster runner.
They were neck and neck during the first race too. I mean, you know what I mean? It was like inches. Like
I wonder, talking for the Frank, you know, Dylan, I think, or like
Frank Dunn. Yeah.
Dunn. There you go. Would that be a lot?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know what was going through poor Archie's head at the end there too. Maybe he was even thinking, I should have taken the messenger job.
Right.
You know, it's tougher to watch the second time around because you know
exactly
what's it's, you know, I, like if you're a fan of MASH. That final episode of season 3 is way harder to watch on a repeat version than it is the first time you're watching it.
Oh, God. Yep.
It's just, you know, it's tragedy, but again, it's, you know, the true cost of war, but the true bravery of the soldiers that fight it. You know, even though, you know, Archie was the more idealistic one and Frank was the more cynical one. But I think Frank was willing to take that charge, too.
Yeah.
You know, no, right up until he had the relief of being named as messenger. He was, you know, because, again, there was no way he was going to let Archie go over that wall without being right there beside him.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, Frank was like the Han Solo, but like after Han Solo sort of committed to the cause, right? Like,
right. There you go.
I think it was, I can't remember, it was William Fichtner's character or Eric Bana's character in Black Hawk Down that says the line, "You do it for the man standing next to you." And you can't expect, you know, people ask all the time, you know, why do you do it? Well, you can't expect, they're never going to understand it until they have to do it.
Right.
Bana at the end.
Yeah, I know it was either him or Fichtner, but I can't remember which. But I mean, yeah, it's something you're not going to understand until you're in that position.
Right.
And I'm fine with not having, without understanding it.
Right. I'm fine with not being in that position.
And, I mean, I definitely, you know, I watch these things and I'm always like, I definitely like identify with the, you know, like the Mel Gibson character. I definitely identify going with the guy saying like, why the hell do I want to fight for England? I'm Australian, you know, whatever.
Right.
I'm an right, Irish guy living in Australia, you know, whatever.
That they meet, the one who tells them, the one who they meet like on the drive around, who has no idea what's even going on.
Oh yeah.
He's just war, like out there. Yeah. I'd be that guy.
Which, yeah. By the way, I had no idea there were camels in Australia. I guess it makes sense, but I had no idea.
They may have been.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like, I thought that was interesting, and I kind of looked it up. Apparently, at one point, there were camels in Texas as well, although they eventually died out.
Well, every now and then you hear the story that, you know, there's still, you know, camels roaming there. But yeah, the U.S. cavalry did experiment with camels in the American Southwest.
Right.
It was unfortunately a failed experiment because camels just aren't, you can't train a camel the way you can train a horse.
Yeah, they're not very agreeable.
I don't know if Todd remembers, but there was a movie called Humps that was a, you know, kind of a satire of that. That was on HBO a lot too.
I vaguely remember that.
I have not seen that.
Yeah, it was about a Western about the cavalry trying to train.
I vaguely remember that.
Trying to train camels. This is, I mean, of course, I highly recommend this movie, but, you know, again, it's not a fun movie.
No. No, it's a damn good one, though. On pretty much, it's a great story. It's a great ending. It's great acting. It's a great director. Beautifully shot. Excellent music. You know, all of that is more than worth your while.
I agree with all that. And I'll also add, you know, saying this as somebody who, you know, I don't think I'm alone in not really caring much for Mel Gibson's, at least his personal life over the last 20 years or so, some of the choices he's made. But boy, did he have fucking charisma. Or,
oh, yeah.
Or Riz, as the kids call it. man had Riz, like,
and for real, and
beautiful blue eyes too, like Jesus, like I, you know, so you forget sometimes, like I feel like, you know, he gets to like Lethal Weapon and then, you know, it's, he's like real jokey, you know, kind of character, but you forget, like, especially in those Mad Max movies, like he's just like really intense, you know, like,
oh yeah,
had a really intense charisma.
Yeah, I mean, he was a talented actor.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's one of those where I'm just, I got to try to separate the art from the artist. And, you know, other people have, you know, obviously worked on these movies.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, it's a little easier to get past.
Yeah. Exactly. Like if you're gonna find every movie is made by hundreds of people. If you dig hard enough, you're gonna find an asshole somewhere. Like, yes. Are you just gonna not watch any movies then? You know, like,
right?
Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah. If you dig too deep, you know, but.
Well, unfortunately, you usually don't have to dig very deep, but.
Well, no, I mean, some people make it real easy. That's true. I mean, I'm just saying, like, you know, if you could just say, well, I'm not going to watch this movie because it starred so-and-so, and you'd be like, well, this movie, you know, the director of photography did this, you know, like, you could always argue, like, if you're going to, like, use that as your measuring stick. Like, just don't watch movies because people are terrible.
Well, yeah. That and like, say, you know, even Mad Max or Lethal Weapons, there is something. This movie has a statement. You know, there is, you know, and it's whether you're Australian or not,
right?
And I can definitely see why this is, you know, so hugely popular in Australia.
It's a fantastic movie.
You know, there's so much there making it worth your while, no matter how much you may dislike Mel Gibson.
Right.
I should also point out that, you know, my Whistle Award winner is Bill Hunter, who played Major Barton, the unfortunate officer in charge of sending the waves over the trenches.
Yeah, he was my choice as well, actually.
I considered him. I was considering Uncle Jack, and then I considered Barton, but ultimately I went with that dog. Remember that dog who was lying down with the guy in the little alcove in the trench there?
Yes.
I was like, that's my favorite. Did not expect to see that dog. Whitmissile winner.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, now it's a me many times, but I can't understate just how much I really like the soundtrack. How much the soundtrack really worked here. That and beautiful.
Yeah.
I forgot to check to see who the cinematographer was, but just, you know, done.
Now this is it's a conundrum in that it seems like it's an anti-war movie, but again, it's not. It doesn't seem like it's taking a side.
Right. I think it's more of an is what it is kind of movie.
Yes. Yeah.
It's, you're right. Like it kind of like rides the line there. Cause it's definitely like, you know, yeah, these guys are patriotic, you know, like they went and they died, you know, ostensibly for their country, but there's also like, look at how effing senseless this is, you know, like,
right.
So yeah, I think it kind of plays both sides there, which is probably, you know, if this is a revered movie in Australia, I could see why.
And, you know, again, it's like, you know, World War One, they didn't even really, again, they point out, they don't even really know, like, well, what, we know we're fighting the Germans and the German allies and they're the bad guys, but we don't really know what it's all about.
Right.
Right.
There's no, like, you know, there's no Hitler in World War One. Like there's no like obvious villain, you know,
right.
It's just like, oh, we're just fighting the other side.
And Australia is so far away. I think Australia
so far removed
from it than even the United States was.
Yeah, like what Arch says, like, well, cause they could come here or something like that. Is it?
And if,
exactly.
And even Frank is like, come here for what?
Yeah.
Like, come on, dude. They're not going to come here.
Our one camel? I mean, come on.
It would take a heck of a form. Like, first you're going to get there.
Yeah. And then you're going
to stand
when you arrive. Yeah.
Which I'm sure is what a lot of folks are asking in World War I. With how all those, like, you know, how all those, like, different pieces fit together. It's like, what? We're because, okay, well, I guess I got to be where, like, all right, you're backing me up in this fight, right? Except it's, you know, thousands of people, you know, being butchered or so a day per engagement by artillery fire, you know.
I know some of it.
How did we get here?
Is that there was the belief that World War One was going to be the war that ended all wars. Like,
right, because it was just so awful.
Yeah, it's so awful, but also once we win, like once the Allied wins, there'll be no reason to fight these wars anymore. If only.
Yeah.
So unless we got anything else to say about Gallipoli itself, I suppose we can move on to recommendations.
Yeah. Yeah, let's do it.
All right,
Sean, did you have anything?
Yeah, I mean, I actually mentioned this to you guys a few weeks ago when you brought up doing this. My introduction to like the whole, I mean, I didn't know anything about Gallipoli. Like I said, I didn't even see this movie till I was an adult. But the first thing I knew about it was from a Pogue song, And the band played Waltzing Matilda, which is basically tells a story of some guy who basically was roving the Australian countryside and then went off to war and went to Gallipoli and got his legs blown off. And, you know, and then the last verse is basically him, you know, talking about, you know, the Anzac parade that they probably don't still have them now. I don't know. I mean, there can't be anybody left. Right. But boy, is it a sad song. You know, it's kind of why I saw the movie. It was like, oh, Gallipoli, I know about that, you know, and I learned about it from this Pogue song. If you haven't heard it, go listen to it. It's an excellent song. And just thinking in terms of like other war movies, like I really like Dunkirk. And if you want to see like a different take of like, you know, just basically a fight on a beach, but it's like almost the opposite because it's basically the entire movie is pretty much just like action, you know, and you don't really get backstory for anyone really, which I think is kind of like brave, like, because like, I mean, you don't really need backstory to be like, it sucks to get shot at, you know what I mean? Like,
especially if that's not the movie. Backstory is kind of the point.
Well, yeah, no, it is. I'm just saying it's a completely different take, but just to say, like, you know what, like, if you don't care about these people, then that's on you, because like they're human beings, and like human beings being shot at and dying is inherently dramatic. You know what I mean? Like whether right. whether you're reading the letters from their girlfriends or not, you know. So I always appreciated that about that movie, and so that's just as far as like modern war movies, that's one that I like a lot.
One, right?
Yeah, Christopher Nolan. Yeah. And it has Barry Keoghan in it, who I talked about, who I put in the Hall of Fame last week or last month.
Right.
Yeah. Actually, it's the first thing I saw him in. And I was also found myself thinking about The Thin Red Line, which is, again, completely different from either of these movies. It's barely narrative.
Right.
You know, and it's a very sort of ruminative and contemplative, and there's lots of like voiceovers and getting in people's heads. But I don't know if you remember the Nick Nolte character, who's like, I don't know, it was like he's like a career officer, and he's like, he knows he's never going to make general or whatever, or maybe he was even colonel or whatever. And he's just trying to take this hill, and like, it's just basically his desperation to like, get that one last promotion before he retires, and he just basically fucks over his entire platoon to do it. Like, and I found myself thinking of that as we saw these various officers making their decisions in that battle at the end of Gallipoli, and remembering like how that played out. and not that there's anybody who was quite that. Whose motivations were quite that obvious, but it does make you think, like, what are these people, you know, what are these people really thinking when they're out there making these decisions with people's lives on the line? And so, yeah, those are the ones that I thought of. There was something else too, but I can't remember it, so can't have been that important.
Well, I can't recommend Thin Red Line, and I never will. One of the few movies I ever walked out on.
It is too ponderous, beautiful and polarizing movie, and I don't blame you.
You are correct about that. It's a gorgeous movie. Yeah.
It's like Kubrick's Barry Lyndon. Either you're into the visuals of it and the lack of any type of narrative, or you're not.
Yeah. If you go in looking for a story, then yeah, you're not gonna like it. You know.
That is absolutely part of the problem, and I just never to it.
Right.
For me, my recommendations are going to be Paths of Glory, which really is about, it's a World War One Stanley Kubrick movie, and it's about the generals who are in charge, and all they care about is their own personal glory and the medals they will get by sending their troops into certain death for the chance of capturing some enemy territory.
Right.
And the movie is about, it starts off with this disastrous attack that, you know, the generals put in play that, you know, it is unsuccessful, but the generals decide that, well, it couldn't have been our plan that was wrong. It must have been the men that enacted the plan. So everybody picks somebody to be court-martialed and executed for failure, you know, and they all pick people who are like, well, I don't like this guy, so I'm going to have him court-martialed. And, you know, another general is like, well, this guy's a rival for the affection of this woman, so I'm going to have him court-martialed. And Kirk Douglas plays the lawyer who has to defend these men at their court-martial, all to make the generals look good.
I have not seen this movie, and I did not know what it is about, but the way you describe it, it is extremely interesting to me. I am going to have to find that somewhere and watch it.
I keep hearing about it, and you've mentioned it a couple of times before, Matt, but I still haven't seen it.
Yeah, no, it's a powerful movie. And it's about those motivations you were talking about before. Right. And it's pretty blatant.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of movies definitely touch on that. But few movies really dig really deeply into it. So that sounds interesting to me.
And also a movie called, it's a foreign film, I forget which country, I know Todd has it, No Man's Land.
I was thinking that too. Yeah. I was thinking of that too. Can't even remember, was it like Serbian or something like that? Or
yeah,
like,
it took place during the Bosnian War.
Yeah, it's basically, this is two trenches facing each other. Yeah, I did think a little bit about that too.
Two sides coming together all but briefly to see if they can save a soldier who was trapped atop a landmine. And it is one of the most harrowing movies you will ever see.
Yep.
This is not a good times.
Yeah.
Episode. This is quite the polar opposite of Dragnet. that we did in our last episode. Todd, what are your recommendations?
I'm going with, all right, briefly I'll go over and say that two of my favorite such films are and Glory, but I think most people know those movies. Glory, Broderick, and Denzel Washington, the war film, both are two of my favorites. But there's a new favorite that I only just saw for the first time maybe a few months ago. I had never heard of the movie before, and I'm not sure if you had heard it before, but I think you just found it. It was like a Kino Lorber sale for the movie Attack.
Oh, yeah, Jack Lance, yeah.
I didn't know what to expect of it. Never heard of it. 56. We popped it in, and it's quickly become one of my favorite movies. It's really well told. So it stars Jack Lance, also include Lee Marvin, and Richard Jekyll, who's appeared in a lot of movies war movies of the time, of course, and Dirty Dozen. Anyway, the story is Joe. So is a captain. He's like a squad captain. He's a good soldier, but you know, he's also Jack Palance, right? So he kind of speaks for himself, thinks for sort of thing. But it comes to a head when they're played by Eddie Albert. Just not a good leader. He's more like a good leader, though, and taking credit for things. So, he ends up putting his men in intensely dangerous situations where Jack Palance is ready to kill him. And that's most of how the movie plays out, is with Eddie Albert giving these just orders, getting Jack Palance's men, all the while his superior, superior, played by Lee Marvin, who does seem to be a good leader, at least tactically, but Eddie Albert, because these two know each other, you know, from back home, and Eddie Albert knows that Lee has like aspirations to be a judge or elected official or something like that. So, you know, Lee Marvin isn't necessarily apt to go to pull rank. And there's a lot of, it's something that I didn't expect to see in a 19, for sure. To see this sort of like grimier side of the, while it's, you know, Americans fighting in Europe, it's most of the side is seen side and what Jack Palance is dealing with as he's seething and getting more and more angry. And I just thought it was a fascinating film. Well done. And I'm glad you picked it up. And if you can find it out there, if you haven't seen it, and you know, check that one out. Yeah, check that one out. That was a great time to watch.
Yeah, it does have that similarity because, like you said, Lee Marvin's character has political aspirations, and Eddie Albert's character's dad will be able to help with those political aspirations. So, but Lee Marvin is at least, well, not like, at least he has some competence and some, like, you know, won't send people into the meat grinder, but he's not willing to remove Eddie Albert from his command, which is which is the problem being caused. Because every time he sends Jack Palance's unit out into the danger, he's like, don't worry, I'll be there to back you up.
And he never is.
As soon as they find out what's going on out there, he's like, well, I'm not taking my troops out there and getting killed. Yeah, it's an exciting film too, because there is a lot of action going on as well.
I wouldn't necessarily call it a feel-good ending, but it's less movies we've talked, I guess.
Yeah, especially than you know, Paths of Glory, this movie, and No Man's Land, certainly.
Yeah.
All right, we are going to forego the exploitation title this time around out of respect for, you know, the material this movie is covering, and go right to Magnificent 7 Degrees, where we connect this movie to my favorite movie, The Magnificent Seven. Sean, if you got one, go ahead. Otherwise,
I didn't even try. I'm sorry.
Okay. Oh, you didn't. Right. Okay.
This is a tough one.
I was thinking we might have overlapped at least on one. So, all right. So I'll go with, I mean, the quick one is going to be Mel Gibson was in Payback with James Coburn.
That's too easy.
Yeah. And a million times.
That's a good one. So
I'm going to go. I love Payback. Peter Weir, he directed Time Bandits.
No, he didn't.
Didn't he?
Terry Gilliam directed Time Bandits.
Terry Gilliam directed Time Bandits. Why did I? Oh, damn it. I forgot what connection I had.
Ruh-roh.
I'll have to double check that. Matt, go ahead.
You can still go with Mel Gibson, because I figured you would. That's why I went with Peter Weir, who directed Witness with Harrison Ford, who, as we all know, made
that was his, the other one I was going to do.
Made his film debut in Dead Heat on a Merry-Go-Round with James Coburn.
Impressive.
Todd, are you trying to think of another direction, or?
No, I'm good. I'm just trying to figure out how the heck I got from that stuff. You know, I had a connection at one point, but now I can't remember why. And I can't believe I said, whatever. I don't know why I said that. I'm clearly missing a link. I just don't remember where it was now.
That's all right. It'll come to you. All right. Well, unless anybody else has anything to say.
No, I think that's, no.
As
seek it out if you haven't seen it.
War is bad.
Well, yes, that too.
As always, you can follow us on X, Threads, Instagram, Blue Sky. But where you really want to check us out is on Letterboxd, because I'm always updating the movies I've watched, giving them starred ratings, Sometimes I'm reviewing them, and, you know, it's really more about film, and that's what this podcast is about. As always, we thank you for listening and hope to have you back next time.
Thank you.
Stay gold, people.